You're probably familiar with the phrase "ship of fools." It was a common Middle Ages theme. If we can get this thing to work here. There we go. It was a common Middle Ages theme of art and literature, and this is a particular famous oil painting by Hieronymus Bosch, hangs in the Louvre in Paris. The painting is filled with symbolism, like a lot of the literature of that day that dealt with this image of the ship of fools. This particular painting shows, it's a little hard to see probably, but shows 10 people aboard a small vessel. Two are overboard swimming around it. It is a ship without a captain, and everyone on board is busy drinking, feasting, flirting, singing as they travel. They're too busy with all of the fun that they're having, all of the sensual pleasures, to notice where the waves are pushing them without a captain. And they are fools, in other words. They're a ship of fools, enjoying all of the sensual pleasures of this world without knowing where it leads. Atop the mast, and there's somebody climbing up the mast to cut off some carrots up there, but way up on top of the mast is the third head, the 13th head in the picture. If you know anything about medieval literature, number 13 is a very bad number, right? It's a very unlucky number. The 13th head in the picture, and the captain of this ship is a skull. That's what's up there, is a skull. So death is leading the way. The idea is that these are 12 fools who think everything is perfect. They're having a wonderful time in life, but really they're sailing to their death. And when we live for this world, we really have nothing at all, do we? There's nothing left. We are a ship of fools living for the pleasures of this life. So we must live for God, not for this world. And that's what we're looking at here in Genesis chapter 31. Of course, the news this week has been filled with stories about Robin Williams, the famous actor and entertainer who sadly committed suicide. You're all familiar with that story. I suppose many sermons in many churches this week are mentioning Robin Williams. Here was a man who literally had it all by this world's standards, but he really had nothing at all. And without Christ, our lives are meaningless in the end. No matter what we have, no matter how much money we have, no matter how much fame we have, when we live for this world, we're living for something that passes away, and it can never satisfy the soul. But when we live for God, our lives have eternal significance. So the question is, how do we live for God in the world of sensual pleasures, in the world of focus on everything that is in the here and now? How do we live for God? And the story of Laban and Jacob, I think, in Genesis chapter 31, gives us some great lessons on this subject of living for God, because we have a contrast here between Laban and Jacob, one living for this world and one following God. So the first principle this morning, to live for God, we must follow His will. We've got a lot of verses to cover this morning, so we'll try to cover them rapidly. Chapter 31, verse 1. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what belonged to our father he has made all this wealth. Jacob saw the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as formerly. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to his flock in the field and said to them, I see your father's attitude, that it is not friendly toward me as formerly, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength. Yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me. If he spoke thus, the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth speckled. And if he spoke thus, the striped shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth striped. Thus God has taken away from your father's livestock and given them to me. And it came about at that time when the flock were mating that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream. And behold, the male goats which were mating were striped, speckled, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob, and I said, Here I am. He said, Lift up now your eyes and see that all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled, for I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land, and return to the land of your birth. Rachel and Leah said to him, Do we still have any portion or inheritance in our father's house? Are we not reckoned by him as foreigners? For he has sold us and has also entirely consumed our purchase price, our dowry. Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and our children. Now then, do whatever God has said to you. So Laban was a man of this world who lived for money, power, control. Jacob has worked for Laban now for 20 years. Laban has cheated, abused, ripped off Jacob during those years, even though Jacob was a good employee. I mean, talk about a bad boss. Laban was a bad boss. And Jacob has been very faithful. He was patient. He was very long-suffering through all of these years. And we've studied the story about how he worked 14 years for his wives. Laban kept changing the terms of that contract they made about what would be Jacob's and what would be Laban's if he stayed on another 6 years. Laban kept cheating him out of things or trying to, but God was faithful and took care of him. And also, God has been changing Jacob through all of this time. And God does that, doesn't he, through the hard times? He's really working on us. He's changing us and remaking us through all of those hard experiences. That's what he's doing with Jacob. And now he is ready to follow God. Remember way back when he made a vow to God at Bethel. And he said, God, if you take care of me, bring me back to my family, then I will follow you. I will be yours, God. And I will give you a tenth. I will worship you, God. Now God is saying it's time. Time to move on. Time to follow me, Jacob. How do you know God's will? That's probably one of the most common questions we have in life, isn't it? And it's not just the young that have that question. We all have it as life brings changes. How do you know when you're following God's will? How do you know what God wants? How do you know if He wants you to change direction in life? What does He want you to do? Those are very basic questions. Should I take the new job? Should I move? How will I know whether it's God's will or not? That's life. Jacob is in that situation. Let's take a look at the process from a very, very practical, down-to-earth situation. We're going to watch Jacob as he walks through this process of decision-making. Let's look at the process and learn what Jacob went through in making his decision, because it has practical benefits for our own lives, because we're there many times in life. I see four elements in the process here as Jacob followed God. Number one, a desire for change is important. Now, Jacob wanted to go back to his homeland all the way back in Genesis chapter 30 in verse 25. That's 6 years before this. The end of the 14 years when Joseph was born, Jacob expressed a desire to take his family and return to the homeland. And Laban talked him out of it. And Laban worked out this agreement, this contract with Jacob. Now 6 more years have passed, so it's been 20 years since he was home. And still that desire to go back to his homeland remains, for God has put it there. Now that's a good test, first of all. Timing is always part of God's will. And following God requires trusting his timing. The desire for change is important, but it is not all that matters when we're trying to make decisions. We have to wait for God to lead us into those desires. And here is a good test. If the desire continues, then it's a good thing, but still, waiting for God's timing is vital to following God's will. Because what is wrong now might be right a year from now. For God has put those desires in us, but we must wait on Him. So the second element that I see in this passage is changed circumstances. So in those 6 years, Jacob's desire has remained the same. He's waiting on God, but now his circumstances have changed, and we read about it. There's been a change in his status in the family. I talked about how when Jacob first came to Haran, the family there, and of course went through the marriage and all of that, that it's very likely under Mesopotamian law, and we talked about it, we have tablets from the village of Nuzi that tells us all about this, that Jacob was probably adopted by Laban, because that was a formal process, and therefore he was the one who would receive the inheritance, for Laban had no sons. But now 20 years have passed, and Laban has many sons as well now. And so the jealousy begins to develop, for Jacob at one time was the heir. Now the other sons. The Mesopotamian laws are very clear. When a natural-born son is born into the family, then they take over the inheritance, not the adopted son. And so his status has changed during these 20 years. And as those other sons grew up, they began to push for their own rights in the family. And they developed animosity toward Jacob, and Laban himself became very upset and opposed to Jacob. Laban's animosity grew as well. So his circumstances were changing during these 6 years. The other factor of his circumstances is in those 6 years, God made him very wealthy. So as the animosity was developing, Jacob's circumstances were changing too as God made him wealthy. And God often leads us through changed circumstances. The company changes. Our jobs become oppressive. Things are bad. Something happens. You lose a job, whatever. Problems at work or pressures from others make us realize that maybe it's time to move on. Maybe it's time to make a change. And God uses these kinds of circumstances to move us in that process. That's how God works in our everyday lives. But that's not enough either. Third, a conviction from God. A desire to change and even change circumstances are not enough. That often happens in life. Until we get a conviction, a sense of conviction from God, we still wait. Jacob, of course, got a direct verbal message from God. Now, I've never had God talk to me verbally and tell me what to do, and I doubt if you have either, because God doesn't work that way in our lives today. But that doesn't mean that He doesn't lead us and give us conviction in this process. I believe God does. He may not talk to us verbally, but He does talk to our spirits through His Spirit. And this, of course, is a somewhat subjective part of the process, but it is very, very real and very important. We have a sense that God's Spirit is moving our spirits to follow Him in a new direction or a new way or some change that is coming about, and it's very real. We sense God's Spirit moving. And when we have that conviction, when we have that sense from God that strengthens into a conviction, we know then that it's time to move, to change, to follow God in a new way, because we have to. Fourth, agreement in marriage. Now, obviously, that doesn't apply to anyone who's single, but it does to married couples. It's absolutely necessary. So Jacob goes to his wives and he tells them, after all, he will be taking them from their homeland, from their father, from their family connections, far, far away. So he tells his wives what God has told him to do, what he believes is necessary. And Rachel and Leah both agree. Now, this is the first time in the story that these two sisters have agreed on anything. So that in itself is a pretty significant sign. They're ready to go. They state openly that their father has treated them like commercial property to be bought and sold, to be controlled for his own benefit. The dowry, and in Mesopotamian law, the dowry that was paid, in Jacob's case, it was 7 years of labor, so a significant sum of money if you put it in monetary terms. The dowry that was paid to the father was supposed to set the daughter up in life, but they say, Dad took it all. He took it all for himself. He treated us just like commercial property. He abused us, didn't care about us. It's quite an indictment. By the way, just as an aside, it's a good lesson in family life, or maybe we should say a bad lesson in family life, but a good lesson that teaches us what is wrong. Abusive behavior eventually comes back to haunt the abuser. You know, sometimes, and some of you ask me this question about various things we've read in Genesis, sometimes we look at Genesis and we think, well, why doesn't God just condemn something that's wrong? You know? Whether it's multiple wives or whether it's, you know, different things. In this case, Laban's a jerk. And he's been an awful father. Why doesn't God just openly condemn that? But we're reading Genesis wrong. We're reading it from a modern perspective that thinks that God will immediately say condemnation about something. We must read Genesis from the Hebrew way of thinking, and that is that God shows his judgment more than he speaks his judgment in Genesis. So how does God show his judgment? He shows his judgment by the consequences that come from the sinful behavior. So, for example, multiple wives. Every time in Genesis, multiple wives is going to end up in a very bad mess. God is showing this is wrong. And here we have an abusive father. How do we know it's wrong? Because he's going to pay the natural consequence for the abuse. And what is that? He's going to lose his daughters. And that's what happens. Eventually, after years of exploitation, after years of treating his daughters badly, it leads to separation and he loses them. And that's how God often shows that behavior is wrong. Even today, the natural consequence of that behavior is a form of God's judgment. All right, that was just an aside. That's a freebie this morning. All right. Jacob could have simply taken his family and left. He had every right in the patriarchal society. The father had that right. He could have just gone, but he doesn't. He actually talks to them, and his wives agree with the change. And today especially, it's very important not to make family changes unless you're in agreement. Unless you're in agreement as a married couple, and it is part of following God. So here's the issue in following God from a very, very basic down-to-earth observation of what happened in Jacob's life. We often have pieces of this process, don't we? We have a desire. We want to do something different. We want to make a change. We may even have some circumstances that are bringing that about. But do we have all of these together? You see, when all of them come together in one, then we have great confidence that God is leading. When we have one or two of the pieces, we can doubt circumstances or whatever. But when all four come together for a family, then God is leading and we need to follow. All right, second principle this morning. To live for God, we must trust His protection. Verse 17. Then Jacob arose and put his children and his wives upon camels, and he drove away all his livestock and all his property which he had gathered, his acquired livestock which he had gathered in Padan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. When Laban had gone to shear his flock, then Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's, and Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he was fleeing. So he fled with all that he had, and he rose and he crossed the Euphrates River, and he set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, then he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the hill country of Gilead. God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream of the night and said to him, "Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob, either good or bad." Laban caught up with Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen camped in the hill country of Gilead. Then Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and deceive me and did not tell me, so that I might have sent you away with joy and with songs, with timbrel and with lyre?" Yeah, like really, this is going to happen, right? "And did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. Now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night saying," notice God of your father, by the way, "spoke to me last night saying, 'Be careful not to speak either good or bad to Jacob. Now you have indeed gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods?' Then Jacob replied to Laban, 'Because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force. The one with whom you find your gods shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself.' For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them." So Jacob followed God, but he's still very much afraid of Laban. He didn't really trust God enough, like he should have, to protect him in that situation. So he didn't stand up to Laban at all. He waits until Laban is off, dealing with the shearing of the sheep, which would be some distance away when that was done. Then he gathers all of his belongings and he takes off without telling Laban. Packs up his family and leaves. Now we have this little story of Rachel, and she steals the family idols, and that's going to become important in a minute. Talk about that. But the point here is they're running away from Laban. They make it as far as Gilead. Laban comes home, he discovers they're gone. They have 3 days head start, but it takes him 7 days to catch up with them, and eventually the confrontation takes place. Now you have to picture this scene. This would make a great movie scene. It really would. Picture this scene like a movie scene, right? It would, you have Jacob and his family, including his children. His sons are all under 20 years of age, so you got young family here, all of these people gathered in the camp with some servants and his flocks and all of this. And you have Laban, and he comes swaggering into camp with his armed servants like some Arab chieftain, throwing his weight around and threatening Jacob. He's angry. He argues that Jacob has wronged him by stealing his daughters, as if Laban cared about them, of course. He hasn't cared about them for 20 years, so it's all bluster. Rachel and Leah are mounted on camels. We learned that. We learn that in a minute. They're ready to break camp and head out. And they look at their father, and he looks at them, and you have to picture their eyes, their faces as stony faces, angry with their father, and he realizes that Jacob hasn't stolen his daughters. His daughters chose to leave. He's lost. And so, as the tension builds, he switches to, why did you have to take my idols, my gods? Well, Jacob doesn't know anything about that. And so he says, whoever stole those idols will die. Look for them. Well, of course, we the reader know who stole them. Rachel did. So the tension mounts in the scene. We ought to have some good music going about there. Here's the point. God has already intervened, however. Jacob doesn't know that God has intervened, but we know from the story that God has intervened. Because the night before, God appears to, or the angel of the Lord, appears to Laban at night. And he says, you will not say anything to Jacob, good or bad. And the Hebrew expression good or bad means you will not force him to do whatever you want, because I am protecting Jacob. So Laban knows he can't force him to come back even before he gets in, before he meets him. God has already intervened to protect Jacob, although Jacob doesn't know it. When we make choices, hard choices in life, we have to trust God's protection. We have to trust that God is in control and He will take care of us, even when we do not know what God is doing behind the scenes to care for us and protect us. God intervenes to protect Jacob, and God will take care of you. God will take care of me when we choose to follow Him in life. Faith is a two-way street. I like what author and missionary E. Stanley Jones once said. Faith is not merely you holding on to God, because we're weak. We let go. Our fingers slip. It is God holding on to you. That's what really matters. And That's why you can have faith the size of a mustard seed. How big is a mustard seed? Very, very tiny. How much faith do you have to be saved by God? Not a whole lot. It isn't us. It isn't about our faith. It isn't about how great our faith is. It is that our faith is in the right person. That's what really counts. Because when our faith is in God, it doesn't matter. We don't have to have a whole lot, because God is holding on to us. And we're simply trusting Him, even in the very weakness of our faith, even when we're struggling with doubts, even when we say, Lord, I don't get it, I don't understand. That little bit of faith, the important thing is God's holding on to you. That's what really matters. Steve Nichols tells a story of the time when he bought his 2-year-old daughter, Sarah, an aquarium. And they went together to the pet store and they bought 4 fish to put in this aquarium. They got it all set up, and his 2-year-old daughter was real happy with her little aquarium there. But one morning, she found one of the fish dead. And it was in some of the plastic bushes that were down there in the aquarium. She found this one of her fish dead in those bushes. And so his wife called and said Sarah wanted to talk to him. And so his little 2-year-old comes on the phone, because he was at the office, and she said that, Daddy, we found the fish dead, and Mommy and I are going to have a funeral for it in the backyard right now. And so she was telling him about this, and his dad sort of started to tear up. But then he really teared up when she said to him, the last thing she said to him before she hung up, because she had told him that it had died and found it in the plastic bushes, and she says, "Daddy, keep me from getting caught in the bushes. Daddy, keep me from getting caught in the bushes." Huh. That's exactly what prayer is, isn't it? Prayer is, "Daddy, keep me from getting caught in the bushes." That's what we do every time we pray. And unlike an earthly father who's limited, though we would do everything we can, right, dads? Unlike an earthly father, God's not limited. So prayer is, "Daddy, Daddy, keep me from getting caught in the bushes," trusting in His protection. That's how we live for God. Third, to live for God, we must stand against wrong. Verse 33. So Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent. We got the music going. You got this scene going, right? And into the tent of the two maids, but he did not find them. That is the terrapin, the idols. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle, and she sat on them. So now the music's really going up. And Laban felt through all the tent, but did not find them. She said to her father, Let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is upon me. So he searched, but did not find the household idols. Then Jacob became angry and contended with Laban. And Jacob said to Laban, "What is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? Though you have felt through all my goods, what have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that they may decide between us two. These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn of beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. You required it of my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. Thus I was by day. The heat consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I have been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, so he rendered judgment last night." It's a great speech. But why did Rachel steal the family idols? Let's just at least deal with that one for a minute. Why do you think she stole the family idols? We have, by the way, many examples of these terrapin, these family idols. They're in museums all over the world because we've uncovered many, many examples of them. They were generally 2 to 3 inches tall. Occasionally there's a bigger one, but most of them are 2 to 3 inches tall, and they're little figurines, usually a female figurine. There are several reasons or combination of reasons that Rachel might have had to steal the idols. Possibly number one, Rachel still held some faith in the idols herself. She comes from a pagan background. She believed in the God of Jacob, but still clung to those idols to some extent. You know, that's the way life is oftentimes. We cling to those things that were a part of our lives before. Secondly, the idols were often sort of like lucky charms. So they would carry them to ward off evil, that sort of thing. And maybe she wanted them on their journey. Three, many of these idols were fertility goddesses. And we know that Rachel was obsessed with having children, and maybe she thought the idols would help her have children. She still has some superstitious faith. Four, the family idols, and here's a very important one, the family idols had legal significance. We don't understand that in our culture, but we know from the Nuzi tablets and many other archaeological finds that in the ancient world, the family idols were the symbol of the inheritance. And whoever was given those family idols, usually the first son, the oldest son, was given those family idols, that was proof that he was heir to what the father had. So many writers argue that Rachel, yes, she may have had some superstition, she may have had some false faith and that sort of thing. Maybe she just also wanted to get back at her dad too, some of that. But probably was thinking in terms of her inheritance, her children's inheritance, Jacob's inheritance, which was demonstrated by who had the family idols, and that she took them for that reason as proof of their inheritance. At any rate, she has them. She's hidden them in her saddlebags on the camel. Eastern custom required that children, especially female children, stand in the presence of the father, but she was already seated on her camel, the idols hidden, and so she begs off from that. So we have this very tense scene as Laban's men are throwing through all the stuff that hasn't yet been packed up and looking for all of this, find nothing, and when it is all over, Jacob has finally had it with his father-in-law. He's finally had it. And what follows is the longest recorded speech in the Bible that we have of Jacob. So we learn more about Jacob in this one speech that he gives. It's like finally he speaks up and he launches and he lays it all out and he is offended and he stands up to Laban. He has not stood up to Laban for 20 years. The patriarch was in control, and he has not stood up to Laban for 20 years despite the control, despite the cheating, despite the abuse, despite the harm. He has not stood up to Laban at all. Now he stands up to Laban. And he points out all the wrongs that Laban had committed over the years. And he stands on truth and against injustice and all the wrongs that Laban had done to him and to his daughters and to the family. There are times in our lives, there may come a time in your life or mine where we have to stand up and speak about wrong. We must speak out. We can't be silent forever in the face of wrong. That's true whether it's a family dispute or dealing with our culture and the world in which we live and our nation. There are times when we, followers of Jesus, need to speak out against things that are wrong in the family or things that are wrong in our culture. Wrong is wrong, and we must stand up for truth. We can't be mousy forever. And Jacob has finally reached that point. This past week, I read, or previous week on vacation, I read the book Mission at Nuremberg. It's a story of the Nazi war crimes trials. And you know, there was a movie put out called Nuremberg a few years ago. It was based on a different book, but the same basic stories of the military tribunal. And in one scene in that movie, and it's very similar to the stories I was reading in the book, Nazi defendant Hans Frank is attempting to explain his actions to army psychologist Gustav Gilbert. And Frank explains, now this is a man standing trial at the war crimes tribunal for all of the genocide and the horrible things that were done by the Nazis. And Hans Frank explains, "I turned my diaries over to the Americans voluntarily. You see, they prove that I tried to resign as Governor General of Poland," because he was accused of atrocities there. "I did not approve of the persecution of the Jews. Anyone reading my diaries, they will know what was in my heart. They will understand that such things I wrote about Jews, the orders I signed, they were not sincere." "I believe you, Frank," says the psychologist, "and yet you did those things. How do you explain it?" "I don't mean legally. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a judge. I mean, how do you explain it to yourself that you did those awful things?" "I don't know," replies Hans Frank. "It's as though I am two people. The Hans Frank you see here and Hans Frank the Nazi leader. I wonder how the other Frank could do such terrible things. This Frank looks at that Frank and says, "You're a terrible man." And what does that Frank say back? The psychologist asks. Frank replies, he says, "I just wanted to keep my job. I just wanted to keep my job." And in the chronicle that I was reading, that refrain comes back again and again at the Nazi War Crimes Tribunal. We didn't want to, it's not our fault. I didn't mean to do those horrible things. I didn't kill anybody. I was just trying to keep my job. But at what cost? At what cost? When do you stand up for what is right and against wrong? At what point do you do that? Or do you just continue, "I just want to keep my job. I just want to keep things okay. I just want to keep going." And it's not just issues of morality in our culture, but it is also issues in our families that require us to stand up and say something is wrong. We can't just keep going forever. And when there's abuse, we need to speak up. When there's sinful behavior, it should be addressed. And I applaud the Christians in our culture who have the courage to stand up against the wrongs of our world and our nation. To live for God, we must stand against wrong. Fourth, to live for God, we must break from the world. Verse 43. Then Laban replied to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I say? What can I do this day to these my daughters, or to their children whom they have borne? So now come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." So he's giving up and saying, "Okay." Then Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. Jacob said to his kinsmen, "Gather stones." So they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Now Laban called it Jegarshadutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me this day." Therefore it was named Galeed. And Mizpah, for he said, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from the other. If you mistreat my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me." Laban said to Jacob, "Behold this heap, and behold the pillar which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness that I will not pass by this heap to you for harm, and you will not pass by this heap and this pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us." So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain, called his kinsmen to the meal, and they ate the meal and spent the night on the mountain. Early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his sons and his daughters, and he blessed them. Laban departed and returned to his place. So Jacob and Laban enter into this covenant. Now, the Hebrew verb for make a covenant is literally to cut a covenant, because what they would do is cut an animal in two, and they would walk between the pieces of the animal in agreement about this contract that they were making. Basically, may God do thus to you if you break this covenant. And then they would have a covenant meal. They would eat that sacrifice and then some animals, but they would also eat one of the animals as a covenant meal. So Jacob adds a tower of stones. They build this tower of stones there to commemorate this covenant, and they eat the covenant dinner beside the tower of stones. Laban names the tower of the stones in the Aramaic language. Jacob names it in the Hebrew language, but they mean the same thing. It means heap of witness, or a witness heap. The heap of stones is a witness. And then it is called Mizpah. Mizpah means watchtower. Now, verse 49 has often been called the Mizpah blessing. Verse 49, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from the other. That's often been called the Mizpah blessing. It is not a blessing at all. It's often used in benedictions, for example, even today. It's not a blessing. It's not a benediction. What is it? It's a warning. This was an agreement between two men that did not trust each other as far as they could throw each other. And Laban gives the supposedly the blessing, but it's really a warning. This heap of stones is a watchtower that you better not do anything to my family or God will judge you. And I will not, it's a boundary marker, I will not pass by this to harm you and you will not pass by this to harm me. This is a watchtower, a sign. Watchtower of what? Separation. Separation. And we will never hear or see of Laban again in the biblical story. Watchtower of separation. And there are times in our lives when we stand up for truth, when we must separate from others in this world. There will come a break. And we have to break from them because they are dragging us down into sinfulness. There must be this clean break from those that would hurt us or damage us, lead us into the values of this world system. We've got to make that break. And the break may cost us dearly. Broken relationships may happen. Saying no to the world often costs us those relationships. And this is the last time that we will read of Abraham's family back in Mesopotamia. Laban will disappear from the scenes of biblical history. And the sad reality is that sometimes we have to separate from those who are destroying us, and that may even include family members sometimes. It's sad but necessary. So here's the right way to use this verse. Not as a blessing, but as an expression of separation. And I have seen the sad situation where a person has to say to another person, we have to separate. May the Lord watch between you and me. It's in His hands. May He watch between us, for we must break. We must separate. And I will separate from you and leave it with the Lord. By the way, that is a form of forgiveness, for you release it to God. And you say, God is the witness. God will deal with this. I cannot deal with it, but I must make that break. And I will leave it with you, God, to take care of the consequences and deal with right and wrong. Why is that so important? Because when you release that to God in making that break, when you release that to God, you are now free to move on in your own life, in your own spirit. But if you never release it to God and you harbor it and you continue to keep it up and hold it, you'll never be free to live for God. We can let go because we know that we have done everything we can do and we can release it to Him. We can let go because we know it's in His hands, and that allows us to move on and not be crippled by the past failed relationship or worldly lifestyles or sinful situations. If we can't do that, we'll be constantly dragged back down. There is a cost to following Jesus, but put it in God's hands, and it is often the only way to stay up in a drag us down kind of world. According to Zach Levi, the star of NBC comedy, spy comedy, Chuck, plays this role of the average guy whose life gets turned upside down as a government spy. But he says Chuck is not much different. He's struggling with his newfound world of celebrity status. And the difference is that the real Chuck, the actor, Zach Levi, he's also a believer. And he says, It's very important that he stay grounded with his faith, his family, and his church community. The key, Levi says, is to remain sensitive to the Holy Spirit in whatever you say and do. He said, if you're someone who puts their faith in Jesus, then trust him in being led. To me, it's not rocket science. Go about your day putting your faith in God and standing on truth. It's pretty easy. Are you a jerk or not? Are you doing things to benefit you or other people? Are you available, part of the solution, not part of the problem? Walk in love, and that opens some doors of dialogue. I don't think there's any clock on it. And then he says this, your life is God's, so let him do what he wills with it. Your life is God's. Let him do what he wills with it. That's what it means to live for God. Father, each one of us in this room, we are yours first. Yes, we sure don't understand sometimes the hard things that come our way. We struggle with what to do in those situations. Help us to follow your lead that you show us, and help us to live for you, to stand up for truth, and yes, sometimes to pay the cost of a break with this world or with relationships that are hurting and dragging us down. So, Father, we know that our lives are yours, and we live for you this week. In Jesus' name, amen.